And our scripture text today is Job 18 and 19. And as is our preaching strategy through the book of Job, we'll take that in bits as we move through the sermon. But we are in round two now with Bildad speaking. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And Bildad takes his second crack at Job here and basically tells him to go to hell. It's always the last resort of someone who has lost an argument based on reason and fact to tell your opponent to go to hell. The famous atheist Robert Ingersoll said ironically about his godless reason and his defense of it, he said, "I will live by the standard of reason." Godless reason, of course. "And if thinking in accordance with reason takes me to perdition, then I will go to hell with my reason rather than to heaven without it," as if they're mutually exclusive. Huh? A diplomat is said to be a person who can tell you to go to hell in such a way that you actually look forward to the trip. And as George Carlin put it, the late George Carlin, he said, "America is going to hell in a handbasket." By the time most Americans wake up and ask, "What am I doing in this handbasket?" it will be too late. After losing his bid for re-election to Congress in Tennessee, Davy Crockett said, "You may all go to hell, and I will go to Texas." If you've ever been to Texas, you know it'd be a toss-up between going to hell or to Texas. And Mark Twain, in the face of all his critics, especially his who criticized him for his lack of religion, he said, "All right then, I will go to hell." "All right then, I will go to hell," says Mark Twain. And consequently, I think he did, unfortunately. Well, as the disparity between Job and his friends grows, and they discover that they are losing the argument, Bildad is driven to this last resort. In chapter 18, he virtually tells Job that he is going to hell. But in doing so, he gives us one of the most graphic descriptions of the destiny of the wicked in all of wisdom literature, and then with Job's response, we also see one of the most eloquent revelations of the destiny of the righteous too, portions of which we just sang today, right? In that marvelous hymn. Well, let's look at round two then. Bildad, foreseeing and foreshadowing the great day. Point number one, foreseeing and foreshadowing the great day. Bildad rightly reveals the destiny of the wicked in chapter 18. Now, two objects launched from the same place at the same time, but at a few degrees of trajectory difference, will diverge in their courses exponentially the further they travel. That divergence will become more apparent as the journey progresses, so we have seen in Job and his three friends' lives. How great the divergence between Job and his friends. Job has been unshakable in holding to his moral integrity. As a man blameless and upright, we've seen in the prologue, who fears God and turns away from evil. Three times that was stated in the prologue. A view that's held coincidentally, right, by God himself. God's infallible word declares him to be so. And of course, diverging from this view is that of Satan, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Satan cynically challenges the great judge of history to test Job in a trial by ordeal under the auspices of the patriarchal lawsuit. We've seen this established, and if this is unfamiliar to you, or you want to catch up a little bit, listen to those first five, six, seven sermons that cover the prologue, and you will be caught up with us. And then, of course, suspecting that Job does not fear God for naught, as Satan says, he tries to establish that there's a quid pro quo relationship between Job and God. That is, in exchange for righteous behavior, Job receives blessings. Take these away, Satan says, and he will curse you to your face. Treat him like a sinner, in other words. Well, this conclusion of Job's friends as well is based upon the very basic premise of wisdom literature, which we have used the term lex talionis, right, to cover this. And that's a term I hope that you're familiar with now, the law of retribution, which is a man receives in equal measure an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. That's the principle of receiving in equal measure, which will be articulated then at Sinai many generations hence, but here understood in wisdom literature, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. A man receives in equal measure curses for evil behavior and blessings for righteous behavior. So in perfect deductive fashion, Job's friends have been reasoning from effect, that is the great evil that has befallen Job, to cause, which must be commensurate great evil Job has committed. To them, it makes sense. But of course, they do not have the advantage of the prologue that we do. And so they do not understand the principle of suffering that we have seen. That is that there are reasons and purposes for human suffering which neither the object of that suffering nor the observers around him understand or know. Right? And that is something that will characterize all the book of Job right at the conclusion. Job never discovers, never finds out, never has revealed to him the reasons and purposes for his suffering. And so it is for all, not for all, but for many, many who suffer. Perhaps for David and Sunshine, they'll never have revealed to them the suffering of their child, or for the grandchild of our friends as well. We just pray for them, continue to pray for them. For Jason, for that matter, for Rusty and Jan's grandson, Hunter, for example, as well. But we can bring consolation to those who suffer, assuring them that just as Job has on the ground suffering, wheelchair suffering, not armchair suffering, that you have reasons and purposes for your suffering. God has reasons and purposes for your suffering that may not be revealed here, but will be revealed there. And you see that embodied and personified in the life of Job. That can bring real comfort to the sufferer. So Job is a book for those who suffer, but not always the consolation in the way it is portrayed. Well, taking the view then of Job's three friends, is there a more stubborn, obstreperous man in all the Bible than Job? I like that word obstreperous because it sums up their view of Job's response. To be obstreperous is to be turbulent, noisy, vociferous, unruly. And he is that to them, isn't he? Having been thwarted at every turn by Job from dissuading him from his course, these friends have gradually shifted from reason to rhetoric, from comfort to criticism, from verity to vitriol. So, how the trajectories have diverged, have they not, between Job and his friends? Job has grown stronger and truer, while all others have weakened and falsified. Job is God's man in the patriarchal period of redemptive history. So, losing the argument, Bildad resorts to the go to hell option. And let's look at that option, that response. Now, chapter 18, verses 1 to 4. We'll take this in bits. Chapter 18, verses 1 to 4. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, "How long will you hunt for words? Consider, and then we will speak. Why are we counted as cattle? Why are we stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself in your anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or the rock be removed out of its place? You can see Bildad has lost all patience, all sense of formality with Job. Bildad, in his professional exasperation as a wise man, succinctly summarizes Job's stubborn, obstreperous attitude, likening him to a caged brute beast who is only thrashing himself in his pen, hurting himself in the process. Debbie and I had to chase down one of the male goats a couple of weeks ago, and he did not want to be chased and moved. And he ran all around the pen. We had to wear him out. But in the process, he was battered and bloodied by the time we were able to get him transferred. He was an old, stinky goat, battered and bloodied, penned up, and we were exhausted in the process as well. And it goes to show me once again, our Lord using goat as the example of the damned. I can see that more and more. But he characterizes Job, does he not? Bildad. How long will you hunt for words like a pig rooting for a morsel? Why are we counted as cattle, right? As stupid. When in fact you tear yourself in your anger. And that is a very animal-like response. Who's the animal here, right? It would seem, as Meredith Klein says, it would seem that he expects the universe to be redesigned just for him. That is Bildad's characterization of Job. Well, verses 5 and 6 of chapter 18, let's look at those. Indeed, the light of the wicked is put out, and the flame of his fire does not shine. The light is dark in his tent, and his lamp above him is put out. Verses 5 and 6. Bildad groups Job once more with the wicked, for whom light is darkness and wisdom no longer illumines his dwelling place and his existence. The light is dark in his tent. Bildad, that is sound teaching. We see this throughout the wisdom literature of the Bible. It is sound teaching, but wrong application. Verses 7 to 12, chapter 18. His strong steps are shortened and his own schemes throw him down, for he is cast into a net by his own feet and he walks on its mesh. A trap seizes him by the heel. A snare lays hold of him. A rope is hidden for him in the ground, a trap for him in the path. Terrors frighten him on every side and chase him at his heels. His strength is famished and calamity is ready for his stumbling. Verses 7 to 12. Well, sustaining the hunted animal metaphor. You see that in your text. I like to see the eyes on the text. Keep your eyes on the text and your ears on my words. Bildad likens Job to a beast caught in a snare. He's cast into a net by his own feet and he walks on its mesh. The practice of evil and its consequences is often characterized as a snare, is it not? Proverbs 14:27 says, "The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life, that one may turn away from the snares of death." And one of those snares is the adulterous woman from Proverbs 7. All at once he follows her. That is, this poor animal about to be snared follows, who is drawing on her prey. All at once he follows her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a stag is caught fast till an arrow pierces its liver, as a bird rushes into a snare. He does not know that it will cost him his life. So this idea of the snare, popular in wisdom literature, to describe evil, it indeed is a snare that takes you down to the grave. Well done, Bildad. You have wisely, with no little eloquence, reprised one of the sacred themes of wisdom, that is the intrinsic trap of evil. It's just that you've administered a caustic brew of chemotherapy to a man with a hangnail. Right remedy, wrong diagnosis. We've seen that consistently. This is part of the divergence between Job and his three friends. Well, let's look at verses 13 to 19. It consumes the parts of his skin. The firstborn of death consumes his limbs. He is torn from the tent in which he trusted and is brought to the king of terrors. In his tent dwells that which is none of his. Sulfur is scattered over his habitation. His roots dry up beneath and his branches wither above. His memory perishes from the earth and he has no name in the street. He is thrust from light into darkness and driven out of the world. He has no posterity or progeny among his people and no survivor where he used to live. Like a brute beast, that image sustained here, like a brute beast that is then, after being snared, is dragged to his fate before the butcher, so the evil man is thrust into hell, no longer to be remembered by posterity. What puts out his lights in this case is a skin disease. What a coincidence, huh? Job is indeed probably got a potsherd scraping his skin, even as Bildad speaks. Probably elephantiasis, a skin disease with many of the characteristics we see throughout the book of Job. And he is dragged into hell by it. Calamity consumes the parts of his skin, Bildad says. The firstborn of death consumes his limbs. What an eloquent expression for this disease. The firstborn of death consumes his limbs. It's elegant translation of the Hebrew, which means to indicate that disease is the coup de grace of the evil man's life here, sending him to the nether regions and the king of terrors. That is what will later become the devil, the king of terrors. And here the evil man has a new abode. He doesn't have that luxurious tent as he had in life, where he has brought nothing from his former life. That is that which is none of his, right? That which is none of his. Another way of saying you can't take it with you. But rather, the evil man finds he has a house full of sulfur. Meanwhile, back up above, any remembrance of him or any heritage he might have thought he left goes away, as it has with Job, right? He's indirectly telling you, Job, this is what's happening to you. Wake up. His memory perishes from the earth, and he has no name in the street. What a horrible picture of the afterlife of the wicked. Verses 20 and 21 of chapter 18. Where the application comes home. They of the west are appalled at his day, and horror seizes them of the east. Surely such are the dwellings of the unrighteous. Such is the place of him who knows not God. Implying that this is Job's situation. The wise man takes proper notice of such destinies. And he does, and wisely so. And he should. They of the west, them of the east. In other words, Job's three friends are taking a lesson from Job's fate. And they're eschewing evil. Well, that's good, guys. They don't want to end up like him. Surely such are the dwellings of the unrighteous. Such is the place of him who knows not God. Bildad is thinking, poor Job, if you'd only take a lesson from your own life as we have from your life, then you'd be back on the right track. Oh, right remedy, wrong application, once again. I have a quote from one of the commentaries that I've been, and it's so good in describing this chapter that I want to share it at some length. Job 18 is an outstanding sermon on hell. In its structure, its theology, its rhetoric, and its persuasive force, it is an exceptional sermon. It is said that Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, was one of the most frightening sermons ever preached. Bildad's can certainly rival that. I run a training course for preachers. Had I heard Bildad preach this one, I would have had to give him high marks on every count except one. Those who preach know well that the proper application of a sermon is perhaps the most difficult part to get right. Bildad gets this part horribly wrong, the application of his sermon on hell. His sermon is so fundamentally misapplied that it needs to be consigned to the incinerator of failed sermons. It is not an edifying sermon. And yet to understand why it is not edifying will paradoxically be deeply edifying for us. He's got that. He's got that right. Understanding why this is not an edifying sermon to Job will paradoxically be deeply edifying for us, because it is the right remedy, wrong application. It's not true in Job's situation, is it? Because he is not a wicked and unrighteous man. He is suffering not for his own sins, but for a purpose and a reason he has no clue to and never will, but must trust God. And as he does so, he demonstrates that he does fear God for naught. That is, not for a quid pro quo relationship. Okay? Well then, Job does respond in this second round of Bildad, and that is ensconced in chapter 19. So let's go look to it, chapter 19. Foreseeing and foreshadowing the great day, Job rightly reveals the destiny of the righteous. Job reveals the destiny of the righteous. So let's look to verses 1 through 12 of chapter 19 first. Then Job answered and said, "How long will you torment me and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you have cast reproach upon me. Are you not ashamed to wrong me? And even if it be true that I have erred, my error remains with myself. If indeed you magnify yourselves against me and make my disgrace an argument against me, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. Behold, I cry out violence, but I'm not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness upon my paths. He has stripped from me my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. And my hope has he pulled up like a tree. He has kindled his wrath against me and counts me as his adversary. His troops come on together. They have cast up their siege ramps against me and encamp around my tent." Verses 1 through 12. Well, Job is gathering momentum in his wisdom train. His wisdom train is rolling down the tracks at good speed now. In doing so, Job rebukes Bildad for tormenting him and for breaking him. "Are you not ashamed to wrong me?" More and more confidence he builds that he is indeed in the right as he progresses. And his revelation is progressing as well. They have no right to be indignant with him, since even if he could be charged with sin, the offense does not touch them or affect them. "My error remains with myself," he says. Additionally, Job insists once more that it is God himself who is treating him as if he were an evil man, though he's not. Job never doubts God's justice. He never doubts that he never questions his own righteousness either, his own integrity. It's just reconciling the two that brings him then to increased understanding, wisdom, and revelation. This is Job's progress in wisdom, leaving his friends in the dust. "God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me," once again treating me as if I were the proverbial snared beast. So what seems like obstreperous behavior to Bildad is a reflexive response by Job to what he feels like is injustice. He says, "Behold, I cry out violence, but I'm not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice." So for all intents and purposes, Job does feel like a penned up beast. He's walled up my way, God has. He feels like a disgraced prince. God has stripped from me my glory, he says. Job, for all of this, feels like an uprooted tree making room for a shopping mall, if we will. My hope, he has pulled up like a tree, he says. And again, rather than feeling like a friend of God, Job feels like God has launched a multi-pronged offensive war against him. He has kindled his wrath against me and counts me as his adversary. Once again, that word in the Hebrew is Satan. There's that dual, oscillating nature of adversary, of Satan here. There's Satan who indeed provokes this patriarchal lawsuit against Job. But then in the process, God in his sovereign providence is allowing all of this to transpire against Job. So there's that oscillating sense. Who is my real adversary here? God is treating me as if he is my adversary, my Satan. His troops come on together. They have cast up siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. So as Satan, his adversary, has stipulated, every reason for Job to bless the name of the Lord has been removed. Even those of his household take the view of Job's friends. And that encompasses verses 13 to 22. Let's look at those. Chapter 19, verses 13 to 22. He has put my brothers far from me, and those who knew me are wholly estranged from me. My relatives have failed me. My close friends have forgotten me. The guests in my house and my maidservants count me as a stranger. I have become a foreigner in their eyes. I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer. I must plead with him with my mouth for mercy. My breath is strange to my wife, and I am a stench to the children of my own mother. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. All my intimate friends abhor me, and those whom I loved have turned against me. My bones stick to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Have mercy on me, have mercy on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh? Sense of the despair to which Job has sunk in all of this. All of those who used to give him love and respect now diss him as a matter of course. My brothers, those who knew me, my relatives, close friends, the guests in my house, my maidservants count me a stranger. I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer. Even his own wife hands him a breath mint when he gets intimate, right? My breath is strange to my wife, and more than his feet and socks smell to his kids, right? I'm a stench to the children of my own mother. This is some obscure Hebrew. He's probably speaking of his own children here. Even random kids in the street feel emboldened to mock the once revered old man. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. And all in all, Job has missed death by the skin of his teeth, hasn't he? By the skin of his teeth, to borrow a cliche. The Bible is so full of cliches, isn't it? It's the other way around, really, right? We get this cliche in the old King James English, in our culture and society, from this text. Job has become the Rodney Dangerfield of the patriarchal era. I can't get no respect, right? So Job makes one more poignant plea to his colleagues. Have mercy on me, have mercy on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh? It is, of course, because they are witnesses for the prosecution. Are they not, the three friends? Witnesses for the prosecution. They have had no sympathy for him. despite his poignant pleas. Now, in the end, Job, what does he do at the very conclusion? He intercedes for his friends, doesn't he? And sacrifices on their behalf. So he is an intercessor for them at the end. But all through here, he also pleads with them to listen to him. Well, let's look at verse 23 to 29 then of chapter 19. And this famous portion, which is perhaps the most read and the most sung of all of the book of Job. But we have it in context. Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, once again, the idea of the elephantiasis eating away at him, dragging him to the grave. After my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, how we will pursue him, and the root of the matter is found in him, be afraid of the sword, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment. Once again, Job's wisdom train is in full steam here. As rather than denying God's justice, see, he's been struggling with these two opposite poles. At the one end is his righteous behavior and his integrity. At the other end is being treated and punished as if he were a gross sinner. This is one of the solutions, one of the conclusions he comes to in resolving these two opposing truths. He does not deny God's justice. Job affirms it in certainty of his vindication, even if it is delayed to the day of the resurrection. There must be a resurrection. There must be a resolution. God is just, and he will bring about justice. Augustine, in thinking and quoting on citing and reading and preaching on this text, concludes with Job that if justice is not administered and exercised here in this life, we must trust that it will be fully vindicated in the life to come. Understanding in the same way what Job comes to here. Justice will be done. I will be vindicated, even if it's delayed to the day of the resurrection, and concludes there must be a day of resurrection for this very reason. This is Old Testament wisdom, Old Testament gospel, if you will. Toward that end, Job hopes that his case, his legal brief, if you will be remembered in that momentous day. That's what he means here. Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. Rather than an ephemeral mist, Job wants solid adamant for his experience. He doesn't want to suffer for nothing. And he's not suffering for nothing, is he? Nor do others. Nor do those that you know that are suffering. They're not suffering for nothing. He wants the memory of his case to be as certain as his knowledge of another fact, which is, for I know that my Redeemer lives. These famous words that we now see he is indeed speaking of Christ. I know that my Goel, my Redeemer, lives. And this is all, once again, in the context of what? This isn't just out of the thin air. We have context now. We understand that Job is longing for a redeemer in the context of the patriarchal lawsuit, a counselor who will stand between him and God. He knows he can't do it alone. He needs a redeemer. He needs a goel, a kinsman redeemer, if you will. And it's all in the context of the patriarchal lawsuit. A redeemer, a goel, is one who often interacts and stands in the place of another in the context of legal proceedings. We know this from Brian's series on Ruth, do we not? That excellent series he preached, I think that's still online. You can consult it if you want. But of course, Boaz was the goel for Ruth, was he not? And in the last chapter of Ruth, he stands as the kinsman redeemer for Ruth in a legal setting where the closer kinsman refuses to take on Ruth, but Boaz, as the next in line, stands as the goel, the kinsman redeemer, on behalf of Ruth at the city gate, which is where legal proceedings took place. In the city gate with witnesses, legal proceeding, the kinsman redeemer. And here Job is indeed insisting he knows it must be because God is just and he will vindicate me. I know this for certain. Therefore, there must be a day coming. I'm going down to the grave right now, but there must be a day when I will be vindicated, when my goel, my redeemer, stands in for me and vindicates me in this patriarchal lawsuit. And towards that end, he says affirmatively and in faith, and at the last he will stand upon the earth, anticipating the resurrected Lord here, of course, seen indistinctly, seen, however, as returning to the earth to inaugurate that last judgment and the pronouncement of verdict in the great patriarchal lawsuit of redemptive history. There's a sense in which we are all in a drama of a patriarchal lawsuit here and now as well, when we will be vindicated as well. Now we must all understand that he has been goaded and provoked by Bildad and his speech, right? And what his conclusion, what he comes to, is the opposite of Bildad. This is why we see those divergent courses. Because in contrast to the afterlife, which Bildad would consign him to, right? Bildad would consign him to an afterlife of hell. In contrast to that, Job affirms another. He says, and after my skin has thus been destroyed, once again referring to his elephantiasis, after my skin has been thus destroyed, in other words, after I'm dead and gone, yet in my flesh I shall see God. This is the conclusion he's driven to by his wisdom, that there will be a resurrection as well. Not only a redeemer who will intercede, but because God is just and must vindicate Job's case, then there must be a resurrection. This is wisdom in Job, and wisdom we must think through ourselves. He's driven to the conclusion that there must be a resurrection. After my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself. You see how he insists on that from every angle you can look at it. In my flesh I shall see God. In other words, there will be a bodily resurrection, whom I shall see for myself. I will see God. My eyes will behold it, and I will not behold another, but I will behold my God. Do you see, and I hope that you see, now that we have this text in its context especially. I preached this sermon several times now in the life of this church on Easter morning, on resurrection morning, but never with the weight and the momentum of the context in which we put it. So I hope that you feel, that you sense, that it's palpable to you, how Job's suffering has pushed him to the limit. Pushed him to the limit of divine revelation. How his suffering has driven him to see that there is a Redeemer, that there will be a day of judgment, that there will be a day of resurrection, that he himself in his own flesh will see his God. Behold the resurrection in the patriarchal period. Remember, consult Genesis chapter 10. You have the long stretch of the patriarchal period between Noah and Abraham. Where was the gospel all this time? Here! Here in the book of Job. Job is driven to the gospel through his suffering. So we can conclude as well that all those suffering without cause, apparently without cause, will be vindicated too. So when we tell those who suffer, be at peace, your suffering has meaning. Trust God, believe in God, love God. That may like seem like cold comfort, right, to begin with, until you enter in with Job. Enter in with his interlocutors. That's one of the reasons Job is such a long book, and to many, to those who are armchair sufferers, maybe a tedious book. But to those who suffer, it isn't. And when you enter into Job's suffering with him as a sufferer yourself, you begin to see, indeed, that God is faithful, that there are reasons for suffering that we are never apprised of, never revealed to us, maybe not to those around us either. But those who trust God, who serve him for naught, as Satan accuses Job of doing, do find comfort in the book of Job. And we are exhorted to bring Job as it is on the page to them as well. It is not cold comfort to those who suffer. So in contrast to Bildad's assertions, Job will find remembrance, will he not, through eternity. God will remember and vindicate him like he will with all of us who trust in him. Job then warns Bildad and all of his cohorts of their behavior if it is continued to be pursued. Rather than me going to hell, it's going to be you. If you say how we will pursue him, as they've been doing, and the root of that is found in him. In other words, your guilt is your own. Job says, be afraid of the sword, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment. In other words, the judgment of hell will fall upon you if you persist in your ways. And later, Job will intercede for his friends, will he not, to avoid this? Brothers and sisters, behold the gospel in Job. Once again, wisdom literature, a wise man forced to his conclusions of the gospel by his suffering. Well, let us now come to that place where we see the suffering of our Redeemer, the Redeemer of all the saved, the suffering of his life reprised in the body and blood and the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.